The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. Thank you very much for tuning in. It's a beautiful day in the San Francisco Bay Area. I hope wherever you are around the globe at the time you're listening to this program, be it live or on archives, is a great day for you as well. Let me do the announcements real quick, and then we'll start our discussion with Dr. Bruce Cordell. You can call us if you would like to talk to our guest. And the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, the Space Show is a talk show, not an email show. So I do know that many of you listen at work on Friday morning and you email in that you can't pick up the phone and dial, but you can do email questions. That's fine, but for those of you that can use the phone, 1-866-687-7223. You can also Skype into the Space Show. It is computer to computer. Please use a headset to avoid feedback. And the ID is one word, The Space Show. And either one will be bringing you up on air as soon as possible once you call in. So please do be patient, okay? If you still want to email us, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do remember, we're trademark copyrighted. You do have permission to download the MP3 format of the show, which is what we use. You can share it, put it on a DVD, CD, pass it around, help get the word out as to why space is important and valuable to a larger audience, not just we in the space enthusiast or the space commercial space environment or the space scientists. Please do not do anything commercial with the programs. Don't edit them. No private YouTube channels or anything like that. And you know, if you do have a special use, let me know, and let's see if we can work something out for the use you have in mind. And then finally, written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Do go to our website. It is thespaceshow.com, and you'll find the comprehensive newsletter there. It goes up usually Sunday evening. It has all of the details of the week's programming, the full bios for the guests, and it's the only place you'll find the future events section showing what's in store for the Space Show over the next couple of weeks to the next couple of months. You can also see everything there. Everything is archived and available going back to the beginning in 2001. Use the guest search tool. You can do a global search and look for your keyword like radiation or space tourism, or you can search to see if your favorite guest or space personality has ever been on the program. It'll tell you the dates of all the programs that use that keyword or that the guest was there. You can then go back to the main website and use the archives to pull up the shows from those dates. So do check it out. We have a store at the top of our website, so check that out. We also added social media buttons. Finally, after long last effort, so you'll see Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Vimeo there. There are two Facebook buttons. One of them is my Facebook page, and the other one is the fan page for the Space Show. If you have any questions about any of this stuff, holler through email, and I'll be glad to help you out. And then the most important thing there is support the Space Show. You'll see that big button there. Remember, we're a nonprofit, 501c3, with the One Giant Leap Foundation. This program only exists because some of you are pretty generous and you help support it, like Secure World Foundation. And without your support, we would perish into the ether, like so many other entities around the world seem to be perishing of late. So your support is really vital. It is essential. We welcome it. We thank you. And if you have any questions, visit OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. I'll be glad to respond to any of your questions. Remember, you can find our podcast in iTunes, Podcast Alley, Zune, Yastro.com, AstroSpaceNow.com, and a host of other places. So do check that out. And again, if you have any podcasting questions, give me an email. We answer all of them. I do try really hard to resolve your questions. I've got feelers out to try to help Brandon with his droid phone that we brought up an issue last Open Lines on Sunday, and I've been repeating it for a couple of times on the show since then. So you can listen to my comments in the first few minutes of the Sunday Open Line show. You'll see what Brandon's droid problem is with the podcast. If you know how to help him fix that, send me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then finally, the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, do visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And that brings me to introducing our guest to you today. I'm really happy to bring back to the Space Show Dr. Bruce Cordell, who I met earlier this year for the first time. I met electronically over the phone, and on the show we have yet to meet in person. Dr. Cordell has Maslow windows for predicting great movements in space development and trends. He's an educator and a consultant. He writes and speaks on future trends in space exploration and technology. He is the co-founder of 21st Century Waves, WAVES.com, and this monitors global trends in the economy, technology, and geopolitics. He was formerly a program manager with General Dynamics Space Systems in San Diego. He's worked very closely with NASA and the Air Force on lunar bases and human missions to Mars, space transportation and resources, and national defense. He has degrees from UCLA, the University of Arizona, and planetary and space physics. He was also a Weizmann postdoctoral fellow at Caltech. His full bio is up on the website, and you can read it. It's more important for us to start talking with Dr. Cordell because he has new research and new information about future trends that bode very, very well for space development. Bruce, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
Thank you very much, David. It's great to be back with you to talk about the future of space. And I think the first thing to think about is that when you read the news today and talk to people about space, there's a lot of big questions in terms of where we're going and what we're doing and how we're going to get there and so forth. And a lot, it's easy, and in fact, the general economy, I don't have to tell our listeners that, is in a state of considerable uncertainty. And this tends to make people kind of negative about the future, but what I want to talk with you, with everybody today about is that the future actually does look amazingly bright. In fact, I would go so far to say that we're coming up on very shortly what could be the most transformative decade of the entire 21st century in a positive sense, something like the 1960s. With the sorts of things that occurred then, including Apollo, as well as things like the Peace Corps, very positive type decade. It'll also have challenges, and we can talk about some of those too. And this is, I think the thing to emphasize here is this isn't just a matter of being optimistic, because it's hard to be optimistic today. It isn't just a matter of thinking positively. It's a matter of really looking at the last 200 years of the history of technology and looking at macroeconomic trends over that period and really seeing how things came together, because the Apollo program wasn't the first great exploration or the first great technology project in the last 200 years. It goes way back to, for example, Lewis and Clark. And there's a series of these types of peak exploration and technology events that tend to occur about twice a century. And what's interesting about them is the last one was in the 60s, and that's why we're heading for the next one will be in mid-decade. Should arrive around 2015 or thereabouts. And what's interesting about these things is that they are correlated with major economic booms. They tend to occur either just before or just after major economic booms, which suggests that these things are related. And so as we talk about this, it's important to keep in mind there's a long history of these types of decades actually occurring. And the problem is they occur so infrequently there isn't any memory. I mean, nobody can remember back to 1901, or very few people, I would imagine, today can remember back to 1901 when the economy took off much like it did in the 60s. And people built the Panama Canal, which was an extraordinary project and got people basically just as excited as the Apollo program, if you can imagine that. And with a president like Theodore Roosevelt, the amount of ebullience in society at that time was extraordinary. So that's the kind of thing we're actually expecting to see.
Well, of course, you know, if anyone listened to the House Science Committee hearings on Thursday, trying to not be negative would take a superhuman effort, you know, on anybody's part to hear our illustrious congressional leaders, plus some of the comments from the commercial space people. But aside from the forces that want to drag us down, and I think there are dark forces out there that want to drag us down, tell us what Maslow windows are and give us, you know, a quick overview of what you're talking about in terms of what your research has created and what you've learned. We'll have new listeners who will not have either heard you at ISDC, for example, or your previous appearance on the Space Show.
Sure.
So the 101 would be a good way to start.
Sure, I'd be glad to. The basic Maslow window concept has just a few steps. The Maslow window in history is triggered by a major economic boom. And what this does is it's a time when there's real wages increase dramatically and unemployment drops almost to zero. And so these are heady times. People get very optimistic. People that don't normally get ahead are suddenly getting ahead economically. And the sky's literally the limit. Everybody suddenly becomes ebullient in the sense of actually ascending what's known as the Maslow hierarchy, and this is something that Abraham Maslow, the famous social psychologist, came up with to explain how people evolve. In other words, initially, some people are concerned about what they're going to have for lunch and their basic safety requirements, and it's hard to think about going into space when you're not sure about your own survival. And after those needs are met, then people become curious about what's around them. They become interested in joining with other people, becoming more social. And ultimately, the big questions about, you know, what is life all about? How did things get started? How is humanity going to evolve? And these things connect very strongly with space. And that's why during the 60s, for example, as people began to ascend the Maslow hierarchy, even people you wouldn't normally expect suddenly became enthusiastic about the space program. And this is what's known as the Maslow effect. And as long as something doesn't destroy this feeling of ebullience, the Maslow window is triggered, keep in mind, by the economic boom, but it's basically driven by this feeling of ebullience, which is a psychological feeling. It's actually a feeling of unusual optimism, a tremendous can-do spirit, and it's just so positive it tends to overlook all sorts of things, like even the cost of space programs. You can tell when you're in an ebullient situation when people do not dwell about the cost of a space program. And, for example, an example of that is in the early 1960s, when people did not really know, and there wasn't much emphasis on how much the Apollo program cost. That's classic ebullience, and that's the sort of situation we're likely to see after we get out of this recession in a few years, which is, again, the timing of that is consistent with what we've seen in the last 200 years. In any case, toward the end of the 60s, the feeling of ebullience declined, and with it the space program, I'm sorry to say, because of the Vietnam War and budget problems and just the general more negative feeling. And some of you may remember the last three Apollo missions to the moon were canceled in that environment. And that's when you began to see a decline out of this ebullient pro-exploration, pro-technology, very positive mindset for people in this country and elsewhere. So in a nutshell, that's kind of how it works. That's what we expect to see. Obviously, to trigger this, people have to feel good. They have to feel positive, and we're in truly counter-ebullient times right now. It doesn't get much more counter-ebullient than this. And this is, by the way, similar to what classic Keynesian economics talk calls animal spirits, a time when investors are so negative about things that they can't see positive opportunities coming along. I think we're immersed to some extent in that kind of psychology. This is not new. This happens quite often. But the difference here is that the long-term timing indicates fairly clearly that we're headed for a brand new 1960s-style decade by mid-decade.
Okay, so that's kind of the overview of what you're able to predict and how you're able to do it and what these trends mean. So let's go look at why you think, counter to what we all know is going on in the country today, that we're going to be in for boom times in the near future. And does a change of presidency, should that happen, a change of administration, make a difference in this? Because surely at least some policies will change.
Sure. Politics is a big part of this because politics and economics are obviously intertwined. And to some extent, the White House can set economic policy and have a big psychological impact on how things are working. But it's not really just about that. That aspect of it is actually driven probably more by the economics and the psychology of the population as that changes into a more positive thing. Let's talk about one specific thing. There's lots of negative things to talk about, and let me show you how one negative thing that we all know about actually is a harbinger of better times ahead. And there are a lot of these things. Things that look particularly bad right now are actually run-of-the-mill precursors for this boom time that we call a Maslow window. The one that I'm thinking about is education. Every time you pick up the newspaper, there's usually a new story about how U.S. education is not meeting the level that it needs for global competitiveness. That's usually the main concern. And there's something wrong with the U.S. educational system, and everybody, there's a lot of finger-pointing that goes on. And, for example, in the Wall Street Journal recently, they were talking about SAT scores in reading and writing.
Oh, yeah, they're horrible, right?
They set new records for being as bad. They're the worst ever recorded. And the problem is even worse than that. There were less. It was about 43% of the graduating class of 2011 was scored high enough to be ready to go to college. And that's actually an upper-level estimate because it's more like probably 25 or 30% if you look at the ACT, which is the other test. And so, and this isn't all. This is just reading and writing we're talking about in terms of the SATs. The math and science scores have been documented to be pretty bad, too. And I can quote one for you. A test of 15-year-olds in math, science, and reading, and this was given to 15-year-olds in 65 countries, Shanghai actually came in number one in the world, which suggests that the Chinese are doing something right in their education system. And unfortunately for us, the U.S. was in, quote, the middle of the pack, unquote. This is the kind of thing that raises concerns about our kids, and our future. It doesn't seem to point to anything positive. But what's interesting is if you go back to the 50s, just prior to Sputnik, and Sputnik was the first artificial satellite ever launched in 1957 by the Soviets, the Russians, and it was a surprise launch. They didn't announce it until after it happened. Okay, everybody panicked. It was the shock of the century, and it didn't take long for people to begin to point fingers at the U.S. education system, why we had been failed and all this kind of stuff. And my favorite story is Scholastic Magazine, which
yeah,
I used to read as a kid.
Yeah, I remember that.
Actually declared that we should be in a classroom, a quote, classroom Cold War, unquote. It's the kind of the level of the rhetoric indicates how much the concern was. It's hard to imagine, I think, for most of us today, unless we lived through it, thinking back on the launch of this little satellite would freak out the whole Western world the way it did, but it actually did. And a few months later, a Gallup poll showed that about 70% of the U.S. adult population felt that U.S. high school students needed to improve. Okay, so everybody was very concerned about U.S. education. And, of course, this led to a mobilization of literally the K through 12 system and, of course, the college system. And a whole bunch of new scientists and engineers and others were churned out. And the whole thing led to the space race and the first landing on the moon in 1969. So it's almost like we're living through, not that it's a pleasant thing, it doesn't give me any pleasure to talk about it, but it's almost like we're going into a period like that again. The situation with the U.S. education system is probably not as bad as the statistics suggest, although there probably is a cultural problem that may not have existed in the 50s. In other words, kids today are not that interested, many of them, in science, in math, just because of a cultural influence. And I don't know exactly why that is, but that's my personal experience, too, with young people today, some young people.
Let me just offer a comment on that.
Sure.
I was at a recent event in Los Angeles for bringing a space shuttle Endeavour to the California Science Museum. And at the presentation program that I attended, you know, they were talking about how Endeavour was going to be so great to motivate and inspire school kids and all of that. And so they began talking about Los Angeles Unified School District. So for those of you who don't know very much about Los Angeles Unified School District, consider yourself lucky. So, I mean, that's probably the kindest thing that I can say about it. But one of the comments that they made, and they treated it as an asset, not as a challenge, was that we have such a diverse and incredible Los Angeles Unified School District population. Over 110 languages are spoken within the school district.
Wow.
And I was standing next to a guy there from NASA headquarters, and I said, that's why it's such a crummy school district. They don't have English only as a rule, and you can't possibly have teachers that can teach in 110 languages in all of the different schools.
Sure.
And that, it to me, is not that I'm putting down other languages, I'm not, but we didn't have that in the 50s when we were going dealing with Sputnik and trying to get motivated and inspired. We didn't have that kind of communication issue among our school kid population, which we have in many, many communities around America today. We have our society and culture is really different and transformed.
Sure. Just to underline that, last year the National Academy of Sciences quoted the statistic that said 78% of our students are not ready for math, science, and reading courses, beginning math, science, and reading courses at a college level. And, of course, the National Academy of Sciences is concerned about how the economy affects research funding, which is, of course, in a negative way. And so these things tend to all go together. And there is a problem there. There's no doubt about it. But in the context of Maslow's windows, it's kind of what you'd expect at this stage of the game, because things are bad in terms of motivating kids to study science and math to some extent, and the economy is in a uncertain state, to put it mildly. And so that's the kind of culture you wind up with. And so that's why these Maslow windows are so important, because in a sense, they revitalize the whole interest in science and technology among all people, but particularly young people, because they're the ones who are going to be around to benefit from all of the technology development, all of the exploration, and all of the frontiers and commercial opportunities that are going to be opened up in space and elsewhere.
So, this is basically positive because it's reinforcing a proven historical trend that has led to incredible cycles of boom and prosperity.
It's one of the key patterns that you can see, and it seems to be repeating now, okay? We all know that no one can predict the future with 100% certainty, but when you see a number of historical patterns that led to these types of incredible transformative decades, like the 60s, it tends to get your attention. And that's what I'm trying to emphasize today, that the news may seem bad, but it's actually part of a larger trend or a larger pattern that we've seen many times over the last 200 years.
Okay, so do we just sit back and enjoy or bitch about the ride, or do we need to be an activist to do something to make the positive part of the trend predictions come true?
Well, I think obviously we need to be proactive, but I think the other thing to do is have more of a long-term perspective about things, and that's really helped me think clearly about space policy and what's likely to happen. The other thing I think that's interesting about this, we can talk about the economic trends a little bit later if you want, but I think it's also interesting to look back at the 60s more specifically and kind of think about how the Apollo program developed. In other words, how John F. Kennedy actually went about making the decisions that he made and how the public reacted and that sort of thing. It's a very interesting story. And probably most of the details of it are either sort of foggy in people's minds or they're just not aware of them. And most people don't realize that the 1960s were truly in a ebullient time. And by that, I mean people were in a lofty mood. It's hard to, the hardest thing about this is to really properly describe it because it's so positive compared to what today is like that the best thing you can do is give examples of it. And one of my favorite examples is a quote from Walter Cronkite, who was the quintessential media figure. He was basically the person that Americans went to for news and was greatly trusted during the time. And his quote was, after he saw the launch of Apollo 11, which was the first moon landing in 1969, he said, quote, "Everything else that has happened in our time after Apollo 11 is going to be an asterisk," unquote. Now, that's obviously an exaggeration, but that's how he felt at the time. And that's mirrored by how people in Congress even felt at the time. Their attitude about money was that we'll spend whatever it needs to be spent to go to the moon. And, of course, that's how the people felt at that time. And that's reflected. It's a very interesting thing to look back at opinion polls in the 60s. In terms of how people actually related to the Apollo moon program. And during the early 60s, particularly when asked if you approved the Apollo program, the moon landing program, usually between 60 and 80% of the American public said they approved of it. Now, those are, no pun intended, those are astronomical numbers when you consider it. 60 and 80% of the people said they approved of Apollo. Now, what's interesting here is that not everybody was that ebullient. The sense is that when you think about the media accounts of that time, there's the sense that maybe everybody was in favor of this program, but they weren't, because when they were asked a different question, which is, quote, "Is Apollo worth the cost, the dollar cost," unquote, the answer to that question, even in the early 60s, never got above 40%, except for 2 years. It was, the first year was in 1965. The only year it got above 50% was in 1969, which was the year of the first launch to the moon. Now, that's really interesting stuff, and I think what it shows is that the ebullient fraction of the population, the people that were really feeling psychologically elevated, the people that were probably at higher states in Maslow's hierarchy, were gung-ho about the program and not terribly concerned about the money, at least for the short term. The rest of the population, and this is understandable, who may have had other concerns, were definitely concerned about the amount of money being spent on the program. And yet the program went ahead, was a tremendous success, and even eked out 53% support from the people that were concerned about the cost in 1 year in 1969. But what this shows is that Maslow windows, even in the best of times, are fleeting. They don't last long. The last time in the 60s where everybody was on board for Apollo was in the mid-60s, probably 65. By 66, we were already vastly concerned about Southeast Asia in a major war there. People were dying. And just really a difficult situation began to collapse this whole feeling of ebullience that I was talking about, and that's how it ends.
You got a couple of email comments. This is Perry, who is in Tucson, Arizona, and he said, I was around for the Apollo era. For those who liked JFK, we lived through Camelot, and nothing could shatter our confidence or anything else. I understand a lot of people really resented the Camelot metaphor and all of that was played up with Jackie and JFK, but it really was a sweep through of many, many segments of the country. Furthermore, the higher up on Maslow's hierarchy you were, the more you realized that we were in a very bitter and dangerous Cold War. Our kids were doing duck and cover drills in school in case of nuclear attack. The fear was everywhere, and even after Sputnik, it was more so because we were convinced, as Khrushchev said, pounding his shoe on the stage, that he would bury the United States. So there was lots of support for the space system, space program early on, because we knew we were fighting against a really evil Soviet Union. Now, if you're lower down on the hierarchy of needs, I would think, just like today, you would be more focused on the challenges for your family and your own personal well-being, and maybe even the Cold War issues were not as much of a focus on yourself as what they were on other people. That probably has not changed today. But I don't think in looking at Apollo, you can separate out the fact that we were in a bitter, bitter fight in the Cold War against the Soviet Union that Americans were absolutely convinced was out to nuke us off the planet. Your comments, please.
For sure. No, I agree completely. What's interesting about this is that the space age, in a sense, did begin in 1957 with the launch of Sputnik and the tremendous shock and even fear, and this is what, particularly in the U.S., about what the implications of that were. And that's why I gave one example of how the education system was affected by that. But the interesting thing about this is that in 1961, everybody knew the Soviets were ahead in space. They had a bigger booster. They launched the first person in space, Yuri Gagarin, in 1961. But what's interesting about this is that JFK, when he made the announcement that we would go to the moon by the end of the decade, did not even really know, historical accounts now indicate, that he did not know if the Soviets were engaged in a moon program at that time. He kind of assumed it was. The best intelligent estimates couldn't give him firm information. But what's fascinating is that he went ahead with this program anyway. And the cost element was still very fuzzy. There's this fascinating quote in the New York Times, even in 1963, which is when people were beginning to think about cost occasionally. And I'm going to read you the quote from the New York Times. It says, quote, whether the $20 billion, parentheses, or $40 billion race to the moon is justified, we do not think the matter has been sufficiently explained or sufficiently debated. And the two things about that that are interesting is that they didn't even know what the cost of Apollo was at the New York Times within a factor of two, which suggested that a lot of people didn't know. And in fact, the support was so strong, they didn't really care. Their attitude was whatever we need to do this, based on a Cold War mentality initially anyway, we're willing to do. And the second thing was, of course, New York Times was explicitly calling for discussion of the costs. And this, of course, eventually led to, you know, a serious look at how this was all working out. The other point I want to make, though, about the 60s is that it wasn't just about space. It was about everything. When Lyndon Johnson took over, he's famous for quotes like, we're going to end poverty, we're going to conquer bigotry, we're going to heal the sick, we're going to teach all the young. We can do it all. Now, that's a direct quote from Johnson in about 63. And that is classic ebullience. That is exactly the mindset that drove the 60s, at least the early 60s, and made it possible for us to get started on an Apollo program and even continue it after JFK's death and be successful with it. The interesting thing was that historical sources now reveal that Khrushchev didn't even approve a Russian moon program until 1964. And he was booted out of office actually shortly after that. So it was a very interesting, when you look at the details, it seems amazing that program ever got off the ground. But it all goes back to the importance of the initial economic boom, the effect of that on people, and the tremendous optimism that that generated. I can't overemphasize that. And how it generated this feeling of ebullience in a huge number of people that really drove the country for a long time until we finally got into other troubles. And that's the kind of model that exists for the last 200 years. You can go back to, for example, the period from 1893 to 1913 and see the same kind of history taking place. And in fact, it's even more dramatic because there was a financial panic in 1893, very much like the financial panic of 2008, and it led to a great recession that lasted for 6 years. That, by the way, was a double dip. And that's why when I hear people talking about double-dip recessions now, it's bad news, but it doesn't surprise me because this is typical of these financial panic, Great Recession times before Maslow's windows.
We're going to take our first break, and we'll be back, everybody, in a few minutes. But Rita in Los Angeles recently had a talk with a Santa Monica school teacher. Let me read her comments, and then we'll go to break.
Okay.
I spoke recently with a teacher at Santa Monica College and asked what the percent of entering students were that needed remedial reading, writing, and arithmetic. The teacher said without hesitation, 100%.
Wow.
And I suspect that Santa Monica is not unique in that. I suspect this is around in other parts of the country. It's an issue, too. So maybe, you know, we say, good, it's a good thing because this is laying the groundwork for the next big boom period. So maybe that's the way we ought to look on this. What do you agree with that? Or it's confirming the trend?
It's a positive thing in terms of mimicking previous trends, particularly the ones we saw during the 50s. It's something that we expect to see, but, of course, it's not a good thing. It doesn't make anybody happy to see this. But you can look at it in a longer-term perspective and see this is the situation that is likely to be a precursor to the transformative boom and decade that we expect to start around 2015.
You know, I want to go to break, but I'm really interested if Maslow Windows or your research does anything to explain how we go from a period of great hope and optimism and excitement, and then somehow we end up in a situation like we are today with education, economics, you know, healthcare, all of it, you know, crumbling, policy and government dysfunctional. And as you said earlier on, if you pay attention to the news and all that, it's really easy to be made into a downer from it all and to be negative. How do we go from this great period of accomplishment to, you know, the doldrums?
Well, if you look back in history, what triggers the Maslow windows is these unparalleled booms, and they're all, for example, people talk about 5% annual growth in the economy like it's science fiction today, and yet that's very close to what you had in the first several years of the 20th century. It's also, in fact, it was greater than 5% in the mid-19th century Maslow window, in the mid-1840s to the mid-1850s. And so this is not unprecedented. It's the sort of growth that you expect that actually occurs during these times. And what's surprising about it is that it always, with one exception, which was the 60s, always comes after a major financial panic, which is a jolt and a great recession. Now, to get to your question, what happens, it appears to be that there's, people get demoralized because the way these windows end is usually pretty abruptly. And since ebullience is a psychological thing, it isn't necessarily relating closely to reality. It's unusual optimism, which once it begins to get dashed, it's really easy to get sort of in a downward spiral emotionally and in terms of your approach to life. And so once that happens, memories of the boom are particularly, I imagine, painful. It's like imagining the late 70s versus the early 60s. And it takes a while for the economy to recycle, and we can talk more about that after the break. But apparently what's happening is that for a long time, the economy kind of, the international economic system kind of goes in this long slump. And it takes five decades for it to recover. And the last time this peaked was in about 1913, not the last time, but the first time in the 20th century was 1913. The next time was in 1969. And the next time will be in about 2025, if we're lucky. And that should begin around 2015. So it's a matter of not seeing these types of booms, economic booms, during that time. Now, we can talk about the 1990s if you want after the break too. That was a boom, but it was a different kind of boom that wasn't as steady and didn't involve as many people. In other words, not as many boats floated up in response to a rising tide, as JFK used to say.
Okay, listeners, stay where you are, and we'll be back in 3 minutes with Dr. Cordell. And again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223, and you can Skype in. The ID is one word, The Space Show. Back in 3 minutes, everybody.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to part two of the Friday Space Show program. Our guest today, Dr. Bruce Cordell, and we're talking about his research with Maslow Windows and what is ahead for us in the space community and the space industry based on how things have unfolded in a long historical study of past trends and developments. You can call in 1-866-687-7223. You can Skype in. That's interesting. You know, a year ago, nobody would have said things like Skype in.
Uh-huh.
You know how language changes. You can Skype in. Everyone who has Skype knows what we're talking about. And the ID is one word, the space show. So, Bruce, don't Skype in, but complete your thoughts on the impact of JFK in the 60s.
I just wanted to mention a couple of things that indicated, again, the very special mindset of the 60s. This is not something that's been seen since that time, really. I mean, there have been good times and bad times, but that was a very special time, particularly in the early 60s.
Early 60s before NOM.
Right. And NOM was the thing that brought it crashing down, as I pointed out before. That's why we lost the last three moon landings. Anyway, one of the quotes that really influenced JFK was one by Lord Berkner, who must have been a tremendous guy. He was the chair of the Space Science Board. And the reason it caught my eye was because it reflects this whole idea of Maslow's values, of the way people think when they've ascended the hierarchy. In other words, sort of a self-realization aspect. Anyway, this is a quote from him in the early 60s. He was advocating the moon landing and even things beyond, and he said, "Man's exploration of the moon and planets is potentially the greatest inspirational venture of this century, and one in which the whole world can share. Inherent here are great and fundamental philosophical and spiritual values which find a response in man's questing spirit and his intellectual self-realization." Now, I think Maslow could have written those words himself, although he didn't. It was written by a scientist advocating this program to JFK in the 60s. And so, it's just very striking the way they were actually justifying the program. Notice that in this passage, he's not talking about technology development. He's not talking about geopolitical advantages or the Cold War. In fact, he's talking about the whole world can share. He's talking about internationalizing the whole thing, which is an interesting point given the Cold War mentality. And one of the interesting discussions that JFK had with Jerome Wiesner, who was his science advisor, who wasn't that hot about sending people to the moon, he basically told him, look, if you had a scientific spectacular on this Earth that would be more useful, such as desalting the ocean, or something is just as dramatic and convincing as space, then we would do it. And so they gave some serious consideration in the early 60s as to how to respond to the Soviet Sputnik event and the potential technology and space developments after that time, and apparently looked at things on the Earth and decided there's simply nothing here that can get the same response from people and can have the same effect as sending people to the moon, which is a very interesting thing when most people aren't aware that they really looked at other options. And I think the other thing which is most interesting, and this is again reflects the values of Maslow in the sense of thinking more broadly, having a broader world view than most of us have most of the time when we're more stressed, and that is he actually offered to go to the moon jointly with the Soviets. He really apparently wanted to do that. And he offered directly to Khrushchev when they met to do that, and they declined because they were worried about a variety of things. They kept mentioning that the Soviets weren't as rich as we were, so they were fully aware of the economic advantages of the U.S. at the time. But what's interesting is that JFK actually offered it. And this kind of interest in global cooperation in space even permeated the Cold War. which is, and as I mentioned to you, the whole Maslow set of values was what was, in a fundamental way, motivating JFK to choose this particular objective. And to me, that kind of is symbolic, or maybe an example of how these Maslow work windows really transform people. And admittedly, the economic part of the window collapses within a decade, but still those thought processes and that approach to how to work with people around the world, the international cooperation in space idea lives on even today, and it's coming back in a big way.
You had a Skype caller, but for some reason I did not see how to answer that call. Let me see if they could be on the line. Are you with us, caller? Caller? For some reason Skype didn't give me a way to answer that call. So if you're listening and you can try it again, do try it again, caller. Or if you can use the toll-free number, that's fine. 866-687-7223. I apologize. This is probably my stupidity, Bruce, but I didn't see a way to answer that call, but I heard it ringing. So what the heck? Try again or use the toll-free number. And I apologize if I've got a Skype problem going on. I lived through the 60s, of course, nothing ever could have been more exciting, more productive, more engaging for our future as a high school and then a kid going off to college than our space program. And we didn't care, Bruce, that it was a Cold War program to defeat the Soviet Union. We cared about the fact that this was really cool for space. Rockets were really cool. Spacewalks were really cool. Docking, all of what went on, going to the moon to orbit the moon like they did on Christmas Eve. We couldn't visualize this as a DOD program, for example, Department of Defense program. And when it started to wane because of Vietnam, it was really heartbreaking because what was replacing it was akin in the early stages of how we are and what we've evolved to today. But I had my brother, one cousin, and two cousins serving actively in combat in Vietnam.
Wow.
And so when Apollo 13 happened and the world was focused on, the accident and getting them back, the way that our relatives communicated, for those of you that are so young you don't have a clue what I'm about to talk about, number one, they sent three-minute voice tapes back, reel to reel, okay?
Right.
That evolved later on to very short cassette tapes. The other thing they did, especially if they were at a place where they could get to shortwave radio, was to make Mars calls back to us. And I forget what Mars stood for, but it literally was a shortwave radio assisted by amateurs that would relay the call back to your local phone number. And it was over every time, finished talking, over, so the next person would know when to talk. And then when the call was over with, it was over and out, just like you hear in the movies today. And they really resented across the board this focus on the moon and Apollo 13. And they said, this is way out of proportion. We're over here being killed. And you guys don't give a bloody damn, you guys meaning the community, the society, don't give a bloody damn about what's happening to us. And the whole world is focused on three guys going to the moon. And for what the hell are they going to the moon for anyway? And we're out here in the jungle being killed. And they really didn't get the connection that many of us back home were having because of our love for, excitement about, our thrill for the space program. We were starting to disconnect from our own society as a result of Vietnam, and in many ways, Apollo 13 hastened that disconnect.
For sure. And that's an important case study about, if you read the history of the 60s, particularly the political history, And one of the books I've used is called The Liberal Hour by Calvin McKenzie, which really goes into the mindset, some of which I've tried to reflect here in this conversation we've had. But it also talks about how it ended and how Vietnam was played into that in a very sad, tragic way, like you've described. And basically, the point they made in that book, one of them, was that by 1966, even the positive rhetoric about the future and about space and about everything else wasn't even being taken seriously in the White House anymore. So that was clearly the beginning of the end of the Maslow window. And exactly where it ended, because there's some momentum. We still had the first lunar landing in 69, which got everybody excited. But the rest of the Apollo landings didn't really have the same public impact, except for Apollo 13, of course, where people got involved with the people's lives who were at stake. So, yeah, the whole thing about how these things end is very interesting. And you can go back to the one before the 60s, which I mentioned briefly before, which began with the panic, financial panic of 1893. And went through the six-year-long Great Recession, which followed that, ending in the late 1890s. And economists today are beginning to see, I've seen some conversations about this, where people are recognizing there are probably as many, if not more, economic parallels between what happened in the panic of 2008 and what's continuing to happen and the 1890s, as there are with the Great Depression. People initially were looking for parallels with the Great Depression in the 30s, but now are beginning to see that the 1890s are actually a better fit. And that's particularly interesting because the way that chronology evolved, both politically and economically, has tremendous parallels to today. That's not a prediction that we're going to see these things happen again, but it is an interesting set of parallels. For example, after about 6 years, first of all, I told you already that it was a double-dip recession, and in fact, the two other examples of pre-Maslow window Great Recessions were double-dippers as well. So this is not an unknown phenomenon, but in the very early 19th, as the century turned, the economy did too, and it took off like a rocket, no pun intended, and suddenly, economic growth was very close to 5% annually and held very steady, although there were ups and downs, but the average was very high, even a little bit higher than the 60s, and the population was ebullient, and I think you have to read the history of those days to really get the picture, but people were, the U.S. took over the Panama Canal project and did the impossible. I mean, first they had to deal with the problem of disease and all the technology problems in trying to build locks, actually excavate the canal. And many people died. I'm not sure people remember, but it was well over 20,000 people actually died, both in the early French effort and in the American effort. And so it was a tremendous cost in human life, and yet people pushed ahead with it because Theodore Roosevelt and other people realized that it would change the world. It was transformative. It made the U.S. into a global power, economically and otherwise. And so this was kind of the centerpiece of that Maslow window. And part of the reason it was possible was because of this tremendous economic boom, which followed a very similar economic crisis to the one that we've lived through and are continuing to experience now. It's patterns like this, and this is not the only one. This is typical of what you see over the last 200 years before Maslow windows. It's patterns like that that make me optimistic that we're headed for another one of these transformative decades by 2015, give or take. It's hard to be precise about the time. And, of course, during that Maslow window, it wasn't just the Panama Canal. You could talk forever about how that transformed everything and the technology involved. And people have made parallels between the Apollo program, particularly the technology and the management challenges and the costs between the two programs. So people have seen parallels between these two programs for a long time. But it wasn't just that. It was the fact that there was an international interest in this, first of all, discovering and then finally exploring the North and South polar regions. And I think this first came home to me several years ago when I was reading about the exploration of the North Pole. And in a book that was written in the 50s, they were saying that it was one of the top 100 events in the whole history of humankind. And I thought,
was what, the North Pole?
The discovery of the North Pole, the actual Admiral Peary going there and being first. And I'd never thought about these events, the polar explorations, as being that significant before. That's because I wasn't born until many decades after it and didn't appreciate it. But in fact, it was analogous. The feeling was called pole mania. It was as urgent as the Apollo program going to the moon was for Americans and others in the 1960s. And people died during these expeditions. And in reality, there wasn't much science going on. It was a pure adventure thing. You were taking dog sleds and to the pole and trying to be the first. And there was even controversy. The history is fascinating. There was even to this day, there's some controversy about whether Peary actually got to the pole, although most people now believe that he did. But what's even more interesting is the South Pole discovery was made by Amundsen about a year or so later. And it has parallels to the Sputnik thing, which was a surprise secret launch of the first satellite. Amundsen failed to be the first to the North Pole, so made up his mind he was going to be the first to the South Pole, and he deceived his competitors into thinking that he wasn't actually going there. There was no race to the South Pole. And it reminds me I'm not saying Amundsen was an evil man, he was just very competitive. And to him, being first to the South Pole was everything. And it's very much like, I think, what the mindset of the Soviets was in the 50s and probably even the early 60s about launching the first satellite and being the first people to the moon. And he made it, of course. Amundsen was the first to the South Pole. And his competitors, the Scott Party, got there about a month later. And you can imagine how demoralized they were. And that whole party died because of bad weather and bad planning and just one catastrophe after another. So it has a sad ending, and it shows what was really at stake during those expeditions. They were international. People were willing to risk their lives. It's very much like what the space race was like. People died getting ready to go to the moon, testing all the systems. And so the parallels, it shows that while they had lower technology and they weren't going to the moon, an off-world destination, still they were doing something. They were going to the last place on Earth that really was considered to be totally unknown. It's a very strong parallel, and it indicates that the Apollo program was not the first time people got really riveted and even obsessed with major exploration and major technology programs.
Helen in Phoenix, Arizona, said, do you see any comparisons to the people who died going west with Manifest Destiny? After all, there is a story of the Donner Party.
You know, that's really interesting because the Donner Party, I remember reading about that a while back, too, a few years ago. That's a real parallel, in fact, to what we were just talking about. I don't know the details of everything that went on with the Donner Party, but they did make, much like the Scott Party, people have suggested that they could have planned their expedition better. They were unlucky, of course. They had the worst snow in decades.
Yeah, everything was against them, including their planning and strategy.
Everything was against them, and they got caught. And so they had a horrible time. But, I mean, it indicates the mindset of people during these times. Very interesting parallel.
Well, I can tell you, for those out there who are fortunate enough to drive between San Francisco or Sacramento and Lake Tahoe on I-80, you go through what is called Donner Pass, which is where all of this happened. And there is a small, just absolutely breathtaking, gorgeous lake called Donner Lake, which is to die for, just to pull off the side of the road and see this country either snowed under or during the summer when it's all green and lush. And not to be too cynical to the Donner Party, they did pick a beautiful area to perish from the earth. Yeah.
Well, there's also, in addition to the visitor center, there's also a monument which shows that I think it was 22 feet deep snow.
Yeah.
When you look up at that, you realize, man, they were in deep yogurt. I mean, they had almost no chance, certainly, to get out of that.
So here's a question for you that I would not have expected and clearly did not come in the last time you were on the show. This is Jerry in Evanston, Illinois. And Jerry says, I'm finding your discussion very interesting. However, much of the discussion going on today, if I can generalize and simplify it, is a discussion by those who believe in Keynesian economics, which is more and more government intrusion into economics, spending, and trying to influence the direction of economy by what the government does, versus those who are more free enterprise-oriented, smaller government, and don't want as much government intervention. While I know almost nothing about the era when the Panama Canal was taking place, I seriously doubt that the United States economy was being influenced by Keynesian forces, especially since Keynesian was not yet around. But still, I think the United States was much more individualistic, robustly capitalistic, although these terms are probably not even applicable to what went on back there. However, today, where many, many people want the government to do more and more and to provide more and more for the people, it seems to me that there are real threats to the kind of exploration and development that you're comparing way back when governments were not doing or intruding or spending like they are today. And it's not just in the United States. It's all over Europe. It's in China. It's pervasive around the world. And since we're all interlocked, what happens in Greece can have horrible impact right here in the United States. So does your Maslow window research take into consideration how governments have evolved into big spending influencing entities and how we are impacted by what goes on in another country thousands and thousands of miles away?
It's a great comment, and it reminds me of something that President Eisenhower would have said probably just before the 60s, because he was the one, although he doesn't get much credit for it, he was the one who led the charge to make sure that NASA got started, although he was a little bit slow, at least publicly, to recognize the significance of Sputnik. He felt he had a full understanding of what was going on strategically with the Soviets at the time, but he underestimated the public reaction. And Eisenhower was concerned about what I think you're saying, the central issue of how the government is involved in creating these huge technology/exploration programs. And it's a big issue, and it's a big issue even today. I think it's become bigger now that we've been moving toward more government involvement and all sorts of things.
Except in space, where they're killing the government programs for the most part and trying to spend government money to develop the infrastructure in the, at least to go to LEO, to support the commercials until commercial markets can materialize and all of this, despite, let's just zero out the recent congressional hearings, which were a disaster for the commercial markets. But so in a sense, in space today, it's just the opposite, where they're trying to fund private companies and develop markets rather than do big government projects.
Well, there still is government oversight, and
that's a fight too.
Exactly, and that's leading, because this is a new model for doing large space that they're trying to put a focus on commercial interests in this whole arena, but in a way that's never quite been done this way. So naturally, there are speed bumps. I do, you know, I agree with you, David, that it's an interesting point about the growth of government, and yet in this one arena, they've kind of decided not to go that direction. But I think it's kind of inevitable because in the beginning, only the government has the resources to create an Apollo program. And when mistakes are made, they can recover by taxing the population. And if the population likes the program, they'll go along with it. It's hard for a private company to have those kind of financial resources, even though what they do have instead is innovation. They're not bound by all sorts of government red tape, and they can think outside the box. I remember when I was working with General Dynamics, which, by the way, was a great company, still is, and they used to tell us to think out of the box, but the box we were thinking out of was fairly small. And I think in a private company that's not quite as controlled by the government, you can actually do more innovative thinking. And that's obviously being borne out in a variety of, like particularly in the personal space arena, where you just had Virgin Galactic celebrating the expansion and opening of the New Mexico spaceport, which is a really exciting development, getting people into space. And I hope it happens soon and is very successful.
They just announced up to maybe a 2-year delay. I don't know if you saw those articles. Virgin has pushed back again.
I'm not surprised.
And
they did hire two pilots, and so they are serious about it.
I think they are, and George Whitesides is on the show, listeners, next Friday morning, the same time slot that Bruce is on, but he's only with us for 45 minutes, and if you really want to call in or send an email, you got to be really condensed and short. I just wanted to promote that. So sure. Hopefully George will have a lot to say about that delay.
David, let me come at this comment, which I think is a really important one, from a different angle. And
okay.
That is, in terms of what really is triggering these economic booms, because if you remember, I suggested that history shows over the last 200 years that these massive windows are initially triggered by really huge economic booms. And the question is, why don't these things happen more often? A lot of people get mad at me because they think I'm saying space cannot happen in a big way except twice a century. And, of course, it's not my fault. That's just the way it's worked out over the last 200 years. And this has to do with some interesting ideas that relate to complexity theory. What looks like it's really happening here is you've got basically three things that are pulsating every that are about twice a century. One is a great exploration, like the Apollo program. Another is a large technology program, actually many of them, like the Panama Canal. And the third, we've just alluded to a couple of times, is usually there's a major war that comes along toward the end of the Maslow window and, of course, terminates it for a variety of reasons. And the question is, why are these things clustered together, and why are they occurring in these pulses, at least the worst wars, the largest technology projects, and the most spectacular explorations? Why are they pulsating about twice per century, which is a historical fact? It goes back 200 years, so it's purely empirical. And one idea has to do with long-term fluctuations in the economy, what some people call long waves in the economy, and other people, these have been called Kondratiev waves, and there's also an energy wave cycle that pulsates. This is a societal energy use cycle that pulsates about every 56 years and goes back 200 years, well documented. But the even deeper question is, why do these cycles tend to produce these booms? And one idea has been that we can think of the whole international economic system as a complex system that goes through a long cycle and begins to get very interactive about twice a century. And what happens is that Just through really a spontaneous, this is called self-organized criticality. What happens is the whole system builds to what's known as a critical state. And this happens, like I said, about twice per century. And during this time, probably the best analog to this was created by the physicist Per Bach in the 80s. And he suggested that you can think of systems like this as a sand pile. If you can imagine, we create a sand pile, we drop a grain of sand, each a grain at a time, and we create a sand pile. And eventually the sand pile develops steep edges, and sooner or later there's a big collapse. The whole system is changed by one grain, finally the straw which breaks the camel's back, or the grain which causes an avalanche for his sand pile. And we can think of the analogy of an economic system that goes through the same sort of thing. There's a long buildup of criticality, a long buildup of strong interactions between private entities, government entities, and countries, even around the world today. And what you see is a very exciting time, like the 60s, suddenly pops up. And there are a lot of people that have asked, why did this start during the 60s? I mean, it seems like there's no obvious reason why it began. It just sort of happened. And that's the way these critical states are. They tend to be abrupt in their beginning, and they tend to be abrupt in their ending. And what's even more interesting about them is the predictability of events, and the sequence of events becomes very hard to predict. There's a lot of randomicity once you get into the Maslow window. And so you've got all sorts of weird things happening at the same time. Like in the early 60s, you had Yuri Gagarin during the same general time frame as you had the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was the next year, which is a totally different type of event, obviously. But the Cuban Missile Crisis, for those who don't remember, was a very serious confrontation between the U.S. and the Soviets about offensive missiles emplaced in Cuba. And if you've never seen any of the videos about this, you should watch them. They're usually played on the History Channel.
Well, they're on YouTube, too. You can see a lot of the history on YouTube.
And this was serious enough so that people actually thought we might actually have a nuclear exchange. And I remember some of the principals were actually interviewed, of course, in recent times about this event. Some of them weren't sure they would be alive much longer, because Washington, D.C. would obviously be a target. And so what happened was, and this is important when you think about, in general, how the Maslow windows get started, what happened was we survived the crisis, and it all happened very fast, and then we kind of went on with our business and started sending men to the moon and activated the Peace Corps, and all sorts of other things happened, tried to collaborate with the Soviets, competed with them, and so forth and so on. Really a transformative decade that I can't even begin to describe even in 2 hours on your show, so I won't try. But that's something you can check out, that stuff on my website, 21stcenturywaves.com, at any time, because I talk about it a lot on there. But the point is, one never knows what's going to happen. It's hard to predict. In other words, if you had gone to somebody's house, let's say in 1952, and said, by the way, before the end of the 60s decade, we'll have a man on the moon, they would have probably called the police.
Or laughed at you, for sure.
They have laughed at you while they called the police, because they would have thought there was something wrong with you. And yet that sort of dramatic change, that's what the Maslow windows are known for. I mean, think about the unmechanized boats and canoes that Lewis and Clark used to discover the Northwest. And within 200 years, we had the Saturn V. That's the kind of sort of pulsed progress that these kind of Maslow windows produce. And it doesn't take long. And that's why it's so intriguing to think about what's going to happen in the future. But getting back to the notion of the critical state, the critical state and the Maslow window themselves are not difficult to predict, because these precursors we've been talking about exist. A financial panic generally occurs 6 or 7 years before the window, and it usually is followed by a great recession. In 200 years, the only exception to that was the 60s, and that probably was because of World War II, which is obviously not something we'd like to see replicated, the post-war expansion after World War II.
Although that Nobel-winning economist, Paul Krugman, made, I don't know if you saw his comments he made about 6 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, where he said maybe we need a war to take us out of all of this. I mean,
that's a great thought.
I mean, that's not the direct quote. So come on, listeners, don't come and hit me up. But you can go find the quote. I think it was something about maybe we need a war with extraterrestrials to take us out of this,
okay,
or something like it. But the concept is exactly what you're talking about. A war can change the mood of the country, and a real war, because they don't consider Afghanistan and Libya and all of this a war, because we don't have a declared war going on. You know, I think he was looking at what happens when you have a war and then you win it and you come out of it.
Well, the point I was making actually was that these types of early Maslow window wars, there are conflicts and sometimes even wars that occur early in the Maslow window or even before the Maslow window. And this is seen, as I said, all the way back 200 years. And in fact, even with Lewis and Clark, the concern there was Napoleon. And Jefferson was concerned that Napoleon wanted to have a North American empire. And Napoleon was the kind of guy who probably wanted it. And the only reason he wasn't able to make that happen was because he ran out of money fighting his own wars in Europe. And which was lucky for us, and the U.S. got the Louisiana Purchase for relatively little money, and the rest is history. But there's an example of how a major conflict, which is certainly a war, even though it wasn't in North America, played a huge role in the Lewis and Clark Maslow window. And bringing it back to the 60s again, what's interesting is that you would think after the Cuban Missile Crisis that there would have been huge repercussions about that, because, I mean, we almost went to war, a modern war with the Soviets, and a nuclear war in the 60s. And yet, you know, a few years later, what had happened is it just triggered the space race, and we were able to win that. But even a few years later, JFK, to indicate what a great person he was in many ways, offered international cooperation to the Soviets in terms of let's go to the moon together. So he was still trying to work with them, even though we almost went to war. And of course, not to bring up all this early 60s stuff, but the Bay of Pigs was another example of this type of thing. But it wasn't just in the 60s. This goes all the way back. We can cite several wars that were pivotal in terms of triggering the Maslow window all the way back to Lewis and Clark. It's very interesting. The other end of the Maslow window is often affected, at least affected, if not terminated by a war, and the classic example of this one is World War One. If you read historical accounts of the 1912-1913 time frame, they use the word utopia to describe the mindset of people during those times. When I was in college, I'll never forget it. One of the interesting passages in the U.S. history textbook was. And you can imagine why this caught my mind when you hear it. They said, quote, to a visitor from Mars, they would have thought that the U.S. and the world was headed towards utopia in 1913. And, of course, the sad thing is that in 1914, this all collapsed because the whole ebullience of that period, which was maybe the greatest ebullient decade in U.S. history, collapsed because of World War One. And the interesting thing to bring this back to critical states is many people, and most recently, the one I can think of most recently is the Harvard historian Niall Ferguson, wrote an article in Foreign Affairs where he suggested that World War One was the result of a critical state. In other words, many people have had difficulty over the years trying to point out exactly why World War One began. It just kind of happened. And that's the sort of thing that you see in a critical state. You know, both the good stuff and the bad stuff happens. In this case, this is a major war, And those are the types of things that terminate the ebullient feeling of the Maslow's window. And we had another example of this in the 60s we've already talked about. So this is the kind of situation we're talking about. It's not something that's easy to control, because to control it, you have to have some idea of what's likely to happen. And I don't think many people in 1960 thought that the Soviets would try to put missiles in Cuba, but they did. So there are both good things and bad things about the Maslow window. The good things we've emphasized here, in other words, you get tremendous technology programs. There's going to be huge exploration programs that even today would be considered amazing. It's going to cost a lot of money, but nobody's going to care in the beginning because there will be lots of money around. We're going to be in the middle of an economic boom. And imagine the psychology, the difference between how we all feel now and how we would welcome a JFK 1960-style economic boom, 4 or 5% steady. I mean, just think about that. That makes you ebullient just thinking about it. And yet that's the sort of thing that typically happens, and that's what we expect to see in 2015 or thereabouts.
We'll take another break. We'll come back and we'll do an additional segment to a two-hour program, if you can stay.
Sure.
And let's focus on what space will look like and what 2015 actually brings to us. How do you physically describe what the Maslow windows say is just around the corner? Everybody stay where you are. We'll be back. And again, you can call us 1-866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. This is our final segment of our Friday morning program today. And we are talking to Dr. Bruce Cordell about his Maslow Windows research. So, Bruce, here's my lead-off question. If 2015 is the approximate timeline where your research shows we might be entering this period, do we have triggers that we can pick up on in 2014, 2014 and a half? Do the triggers start the day after the presidential election? Because some of us will be gleeful and some of us will, you know, as we say in my world, sitting Shiva for another 4 years. How do we out here in the workforce know when this is about to descend upon us?
The first thing that hit me was when I saw the panic of 2008. I realized that the pattern said that you were within 6 or 7 years of the opening of the Maslow's window, which would put it right around the ballpark of 2015. That's just a historical pattern that's held.
Okay.
It goes way back. So that would be the target year. And the things that have occurred since then, oh, by the way, the thing that people tend to forget, and I'd almost forgot myself here, is that just before the panic, in 2007, the world was experiencing the greatest economic boom ever. The greatest economic boom ever was going on in 2007, just before the panic. And there's a great Fortune magazine cover with Bill Gates on it, which makes that point. And you can see it on my website if you want to see it sometime.
That's 21stCenturyWaves.com,
anyway,
right?
Yeah, 21stCenturyWaves.com. And so what I expect is that we will see a recovery before 2015 that will lead to a boom that will pick up sort of where the greatest global economic boom of 2007 left off before it got interrupted by the panic and by the Great Recession since then. And probably the best analogy for what's happening now is, like I said, the 1893 to 1913 chronology, that time frame. And the politics plays a big role in this, by the way, as you might expect. And while I think at this stage it's impossible to predict who will be the next president in 2012, the one thing that does is a constant across Maslow's windows is at these times, and this is not a big shocker, people are very interested in prosperity. So that's a high priority item, maybe more than at other times. And so that's my guess is that based on historical patterns of the past, you're going to see a tremendous interest in the electorate and probably in the candidates in talking about their vision of prosperity. And people are likely to vote for the person they think will best be able to manifest that.
Maybe I can get in and run.
I don't see why not. and it's impossible to predict who's likely to win at times like this. Because, I mean, when you think back to the mid-19th century, just to bring one more historical parallel here, James Polk, somebody that most people know almost nothing about, a very nondescript character, became president of the United States and changed the world. And he only served one term, and the U.S., through the whole manifest destiny thing, became bicoastal and was well on its way to becoming a dominant world power, and he died shortly after his first term, and so there's really, he wasn't a charismatic figure, but he was caught up in the whole ebullient feeling. Now, in terms of what's likely to happen in space, it's possible, there's a fork in the road here about 2013 or 2014, assuming this time frame is correct. Are we going to have a replay of Sputnik? Are we going to have a big shocking space-related event which changes our whole attitude about everything? Or are we going to have a sort of a global agreement about how we're all going to explore space together? Remember, the Sputnik episode began in the International Geophysical Year. Everybody was together, unified, and talking about how we were going to explore the near-Earth environment in space, and then suddenly we had the Sputnik event, which was more or less unexpected, and you could see something like that occur. If there's a Sputnik event, that'll mean there'll probably be more competition than cooperation, which I think would be unfortunate, but historically there's plenty of precedent for it that we talked about before. And so if you see what could that event be, there are some specific things that come to mind. Some people think that China and its collaborators may announce some sort of a major moon-based program where they intend to develop the resources and do a variety of other interesting things. Anything that's aggressive like that and positive would shake people up. Certainly in today's world, anything is possible, and that would be something that would get our attention here. And I don't regard, by the way, a lot of people think that China is a big threat to us, and I think of them as more of a positive influence on us, because without major competitors in space, I'm afraid we'd be less likely to do great things. And so they may start out, or some other country may start out as a big competitor of ours, but wind up as a collaborator, much like in the 60s the Soviets were a competitor, and during the International Space Station they become a very solid collaborator in terms of working together on that program. So that's the kind of thing that you could see. To be more specific, one of the most interesting programs that doesn't get much press in this country is a joint Russian-Chinese program called the Phobos Grunt Mission. And this thing is potentially spectacular. They're going to send a spacecraft to Phobos. The launch is coming up, by the way.
Yeah, in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, November 8th or
something like that.
And this was, if they could pull it off, if they can land on Phobos, pick up a sample, and bring it back, it will be momentous. And it'll be the first sample return from the Mars system, among other things. And it will change the whole space world. And I've talked with NASA people about this, and they see it the way I do. While this would be competition for the U.S., that's exactly what we need. We need somebody out there doing something spectacular that we can try to emulate and even surpass, or even surpass and work with. So this is all very positive. Whether they can pull it off, of course, nobody knows. And I'm not even sure if they know. But the thing will be launched, and that's actually a joint Russia-China mission. China has a Mars orbiter that's going to be piggybacking on that spacecraft. They also contributed a piece of hardware that's going to be involved in grinding up the regolith on Phobos in the microgravity environment. So it's a tremendous mission. I've talked to friends in the U.S. who are scientists in this business, and not many of them know that much about this project.
We've been talking about it on the space show, and in fact, I'm doing another segment. I've already done it once, but another segment on the nationally syndicated John Batchelor show this Wednesday evening, and we'll be talking about Phobos Grunt again because it's coming up right around the corner. It is a very big and important mission.
Potentially, it's a game changer, and I think that I don't have any inside information on this, but as I look at it from the outside, this is exactly the trajectory of events that we suggested in the 80s at a Case for Mars conference in Boulder. We were looking at what are the steps you would take if you're going to colonize Phobos, and the first one, or one of the first ones, was a robotic sample return. And you need ground truth before you can actually decide whether you can utilize the resources and how exactly
right.
you would do it. And they're following that trajectory. And I suggested a while back in a Space News commentary that if it's successful, I think the Russians and the Chinese will be tempted to consider going further in that direction, maybe even sending people to Phobos eventually. And if they continue to be successful, going into Mars colonization jointly in a big way. Now, that's sort of a picture, of course, is speculative right now, but it's based on what we see happening right now, and it's based on reasonable plans that have already been talked about.
Would that wake us up to get our butts in gear for a human mission to Mars or Phobos or
Deimos
or something?
Well, if you're not invited to the party, that would be considered a Sputnik event, wouldn't it?
Well, you're asking me to comment on what on how people back in the 50s reacted to something and what an event was. But I am one of those who believes that society and culture has so changed that it's really hard to look at the behavior of Congress and of other people. Even you had Walter Cronkite back then and Frank Reynolds and other people. They were vastly different from who's doing the news on TV today.
True.
I don't know that would be a wake-up. event as we are dumbed down and the exceptionalism of America is downplayed or being, lost for other values and other goals that people think are more important today. And our population mix is nowhere near at 330 million today. What I don't know what our population was in the late 50s, but we were much more alike in the 50s than we are today. I don't know what the impact would be on behavior of members of Congress and of society. I don't even know if they would care. They may care more about when the Apple iPhone 5 comes out. And I'm not kidding, Bruce. Uh-huh. You know, I'm really serious about this.
Well,
I'm not a behavioral guy, so I defer to you and to other people. Maybe we're really not that different, but boy, it sure seems like I'm in a totally different world today than the world I grew up in Tulsa.
Well, that's true. But in the 50s, remember Eisenhower tried to play down or downplay the whole Sputnik thing, and it didn't work because it was a grassroots reaction.
A grassroots reaction, yeah. We were panicking almost.
Which the president couldn't identify with and eventually gave into and began to move in the same direction. So when I look at how people talk about China, I'm not picking on China here, but it's such a prominent example. When you read news accounts and watch cable news about how people seem to be very worried about China in an economic sense and the very aggressive nature that they've kind of blossomed internationally in many ways. And if I extrapolate that into space, I think that, again, there's tremendous symbolism associated with space. You know, I've been meaning to write about this, but I haven't lately. But the Wall Street Journal had a very interesting kind of obscure column several weeks ago in which they actually analyzed tens of thousands of blog entries over a period of several weeks, right after the Space Launch System was announced, about how people felt about space. And, of course, given the state of the economy and given the state of NASA now, people are, you know, kind of worried. And yet, in the enormous majority of the people this wasn't a survey, this was an analysis of blog comments. The enormous majority, I think it was like 65%, were very positive about the future in space. Not necessarily the future of NASA, but the future, the American future in space. And I thought, wow, there really is something. The economy can be down and space is still up in people's minds. And so what I take from that is that there's something special about space in people's minds. And this is a transcultural, and it's transgenerational. I think it's a human thing. It's why space is such a hot-button item. I mean, it's literally humankind evolving into the cosmos, trying to acquire our galactic heritage, all of that kind of language that gets people excited. It's the evolution of humanity into the cosmos, and people sense it even if they don't understand all the details. And so it's a ray of hope. And when you mix that with healthy competition from other countries, I would be shocked if there wasn't some sort of a reaction to it. Even with the launch of the first module of the Chinese space station, which is not a big facility at all, and it won't be a big facility, this scares people to death all by itself. Almost anything in this arena gets people's attention. I think there'll be a tremendous... I mean, if Phobos Grand is successful, I think it'll be a tremendous thing for everybody around the world, and not just the Russians and the Chinese, because it will refocus people on the possibilities of humans evolving into the cosmos that we've been thinking about for hundreds of years.
Okay, so Grunt launches in November of 2011. It arrives at Phobos later on in 2012. Let's assume it's successful. What is another precursor of the 2015 approximate space boom that you're talking about. So we have a game-changing mission, Phobos Grunt, that is successful and brings a sample back to Earth, probably gets back in 2014. What else do we look for?
Historically, when you look at what's happened during Maslow's windows, there are three things. I mentioned it before. One is a great exploration, and until Apollo, they were all on the Earth. Another is a huge technology project that dwarfs things of the past, and the third is a major war. So the question is, if nobody decides to go to Mars, and there are programs beyond, I mean, let's suppose that Phobos Grunt doesn't succeed, which is a sad thing to imagine, but let's just assume it doesn't, would the U.S. decide to go to Mars anyway? And it wouldn't surprise me at all, because, I mean, you see discussions of this even now. I mean, the Mars Society, just to pick one, has near-term scenarios for using SpaceX technology that you know about, obviously,
right,
for going to Mars in the next decade or so. And the point that I want to emphasize here, since you're asking me about this, is that timescales are very important in Maslow's windows. I mean, this Maslow window is probably going to begin around 2015. That means if you're lucky, you're going to get 10 years. If you're not, it could be less. And so if you're not going to be launching humans in your launch system until 2021, you're really pushing your luck, because we don't know what's going to happen on the geopolitical stage. You could have a major war occur almost any time in the 2020s. And so what I'm saying is that these programs have to happen fast. And if you wait until after 2015 to start talking about where you want to go into space, it probably won't happen. Programs that are conceptualized, and I'm not picking on anyone here, but I'm just talking generally, programs like Mars missions that are conceptualized for the 2030s, based on historical evidence, simply won't happen. Because that's going to be a time like the 70s and the 80s.
But
you're not going to be launching large programs.
But that's the optimum launch window. So how do you, 2033, so how do you factor in the physics of the optimum time to go for radiation protection, all sorts of other things, with a Maslow window?
The only way that you can get around a Maslow window, by the way, this is not predestination. This is economics and human nature.
No, I understand that. We're not talking, New Age. Yeah, we're not talking New Age hocus pocus here.
And the only way you can get around the Maslow window is to plan for it. And an example of this, well, I don't know that there is an example of this, because this whole concept is relatively new. But I published my first article on it in the late 90s, but I didn't really do anything with it until the last several years. But if you were to take these concerns into consideration, these time frames, then it can be done. And you might even be able to plan through the trough after the Maslow window if you're clever enough. And one of the things that I suggest is that we need to get a deep space presence established. We need to have humans in space, either on the moon or on Phobos, or maybe even on Mars if we're capable of doing that, as soon as possible. Because that's the only way you're going to avoid, in my opinion, another 40 years of wondering why we're trapped in Leo. I mean, since the last moon mission, we haven't been beyond low Earth orbit, we haven't been back to the moon, and this is a question that rolls around in almost everybody's mind. Why have we had this 40-year hiatus in deep space human missions? And the trouble is, the answer has to do with Maslow windows, and until we begin to plan around them, we're going to be subject to these long-term economic forces, because we simply don't know about them. And that unless we establish a more or less self-sufficient base somewhere like the moon or Phobos or Mars, we're going to suffer through the same thing again.
Well, the moon is certainly doable. That of course, is the most plausible, doable destination that we could have, especially if we're looking at the near term when the window opens up. Maybe a moon program will be created and followed through on.
Well, the suggestion's been made in the literature in many places that maybe we could accelerate the colonization of Mars by doing one of two things. Either developing a base on Phobos, because it's easy to get there, or doing one-way missions, where people are know up front that they aren't going to be coming back. They're going to be given the tools to survive on the surface. And sort of like the explorers that first came to North America, they never had any idea of going back to wherever they came from. They knew they were going to North America, and they were either going to flourish or it was going to be the end of the story. And there are many people who are... I remember people talking about this when I was working for General Dynamics in the 80s and 90s, and I thought it was kind of a wild idea then, but I think now... You know, if you're really dedicated to this concept, the idea of a one-way mission with appropriate technology and appropriate systems that have already preceded you there to use in-situ resources and set up basically the first base, that's a realistic possibility. It depends on how excited we get about this whole thing. The thing about ebullience is that it's hard to predict the direction it'll take, just like it was hard to predict what Kennedy was going to do in the 60s, because everybody was so excited. That kind of mindset, which most of our listeners are not old enough to remember, it's quite a thing.
Of course, we're still zeroing out resolution to the major challenges on the human factor side, on radiation, microgravity, mental things, closed-loop systems. The question then becomes, even if you're going to do a one-way mission, can you, protect your crew sufficiently and keep them healthy so when they got to Phobos or Deimos or Mars, they would actually be able to do something useful rather than have to somehow recover, you know, from a very debilitating trip. So somehow those human factors have to be included in, even if you're going to do a one-way mission and you want your crew to survive.
Well, I think I agree with you on this, that I'm less concerned about radiation and low gravity than I am how the crew can put up with each other for, you know, whatever, how many every years.
How many are killed on the way.
And you may remember this, but about 20 years ago, there was this NASA psychologist that suggested we should send only married couples on Mars missions, because that would take care of the sex problem. At least that was...
Yeah, right, until they decide they're going to have an open marriage about 3 weeks into the mission.
People got divorced on Mars is something I mean. But so, I think it was a serious suggestion, but it kind of... I mean, the whole Mars thing is an interesting laboratory for interpersonal relationships. You know, the isolation confinement is unprecedented, and it would be interesting to see how marriages evolve in that situation.
Well, you'd have to have divorce law for Mars, I think, you know, set up and all sorts of things. Listen, Bruce, obviously we're not going to be able to do 100% complete, thorough analysis and discussion of this because we're only a minute away from a two-hour program, so you will have to come back.
Thank you.
And maybe when you come back, we'll bring you back more recently than before, and we won't do all the 101 introduction stuff, and we'll focus more on what's about to unfold for space, and maybe what role we can play in faking it before making it, as they say. You know, if we have to fake our moods of happiness and joy in order, does that play a role in making things happen for real? I have a whole bunch of questions like that I could sit here and ask you for another hour.
Sounds great.
Do you have any, can people reach you? Do you give out an address or do you want me to filter for you?
You can reach me through the website. Just 21st, that's 21ST, 21st Century Waves. plural.com, and you can reach me through there.
Okay. And any closing comments, pearls of wisdom, what would you like to leave us with today?
Well, what I'd like to leave you with is let's all think positively and about the Phobos Grunt mission, because I think that has tremendous potential.
So you want it to be successful. You're not seeing Russia and China as an adversary here that you want to fail.
Heavens, no. Because like I said... They're only our adversary short term. They're really doing us a favor by succeeding in space.
They only do us a favor, and I agree with you, if we are wise enough and conscious enough to recognize at the right levels that this is a gift and a favor.
I agree.
And if we're so stupid that we can't recognize it, and we're so unconscious that it slips right by us, it'll be a real tragic thing for this country.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen, as you can tell.
Well, I hope it doesn't. I mean, it is getting a lot of press, and as I said, it's going to be on the Bachelor nationally syndicated radio show this Wednesday again. He has quite a big audience, and we have talked about it on this show. So it is out there, and of course, whether it's in the minds of the people who held that congressional, you know, panel meeting on the Science Committee on Thursday, that's another question. You know, or in the minds of the policymakers at the upper echelon and the staffers, I really don't know. Those are the places where it's key, and they need to be conscious of what's going on in the world around them and how to capitalize on events like this.
Yeah, I agree.
So, as always, my friend, it is really terrific talking to you. And later today, I will send you some dates, and let's do another show before the end of the year and take it a little deeper, okay?
Sounds great. Look forward to it.
Okay, and listeners, Sunday show, as always, Dr. Joan Vernikos is with us about how gravity and what the space program has learned can affect your everyday life. If you're a couch potato, you're not going to want to listen to this show because you're not going to like what she has to say about what's in store for you. And if you're not a couch potato, absolutely tune it in. And that's at noon California time. Special thanks to Dr. Bruce Cordell. And I guess we should thank Herman Maslow, right?
We should.
And when did he pass away, do you know?
I'm not sure. 60s, I think.
In the 60s. Well, if you find out about his thoughts on space, let us know the next time you're on the air.
Definitely will.
Listeners, thanks for tuning in. Goodbye from Bruce and the Space Show.